From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Tom, welcome.
Good afternoon.
We also welcome into the studio today D.C. Schools Chancellor Kaya Henderson. Kaya Henderson, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
If you have straight because she's here.
If you have questions or comments for the school's chancellor, you can start calling now, 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org, a tweet at Kojo Show, or you can go to our website, kojoshow.org, and watch the live video stream of this broadcast there. The demise of Freshback. Let the record show that neither Tom Sherwood nor I were asked to make any contributions to Freshback.
How do you know?
Making us a small minority of well-known people in Washington who were not asked, and there are a whole lot of people who won't even say whether they were asked. However, the committee has been disbanded. The allies of Mayor Muriel Bowser, who put it together, and the mayor herself apparently felt it was a distraction, and all of the $300,000 or more that was contributed to Freshback will now be returned to the generous donors who made it. But this controversy is not yet over, Tom, is it?
Well, no, and it's not disbanded yet, technically speaking. They've got to, the next filing report is December the 10th. They were still raising money even during this heat that's been on Freshback. You know, the mayor's in China. She held a press conference this morning at 8:30 on the telephone. And the reporters were on that call, asked her about Freshback. She agreed that it should be disbanded because it had become a distraction. She declined to offer by Mark C. Graves of NBC4 to have Freshback, Pepco, and Exelon talk about what interactions they've had about contributions, because, you know, that merger is still going on. And Colby King, the columnist for the Washington Post, you know, has called this Freshback thing, the whole episode, arrogant and stupid. He says it's okay to do something and be arrogant. It's okay to be stupid, but don't combine the two. And so he's very critical of this. And so this, he says it's the mayor will pay a price politically for the image and the hit to her image as a reform mayor. But now they have to disband the thing. They can keep the money. They can give it to a charity. They don't have to return it. But all of this is to be played out, and Freshpack is hunkered down and doesn't really want to say much.
I say it will not go away because even as the mayor is on this trip in China, there is speculation that individuals who were donors to Freshpack, some of them have accompanied her on this trip, and then
that's actual fact. That's not speculation.
Yes, there is another controversy or potential controversy over the aforementioned Exelon takeover of Pepco, because it would appear that in another deal having to do with the stadium, the practice stadium for the Washington Wizards in Southeast, Pepco has made a $28 million contribution, and opponents of that merger deal would like to know if there's a relationship between that $25 million contribution and the merger between Pepco and Exelon, because if there is, it can lead to greater complications, because other states who have signed on to this deal will say, we didn't get that kind of compensation.
Yes.
So the whole deal would have to be renegotiated all over the country.
And I thought Pepco had given $25 to $28 million so that it would have naming rights for the stadium, soccer
yes.
stadium. But it turns out they just it's kind of unspecified naming rights. Might be that, might be a plaza, might be a street, might be a who knows what. And the timing of it coming so quickly, as Pepco has got this significant merger before the Public Service Commission. Maybe the Public Service Commission will ask some questions before they vote on this merger about what was Pepco's relationship to Freshpack. Its relationship to the soccer deal. What's Exelon? I mean, were they trying to buy influence, as some people charge? Was it just simply big city politics, big city business going on? We don't know. You know, I got to give credit to Patrick Madden of WAMU.
Never heard of him.
You know, just a young, scruffy reporter who looks at the details of deals, and he looked at Freshpack, and he's the one that showed that there were people with, I think, $70 million
correct.
In city contracts who were giving this political money to a group that expressed purpose was to promote the mayor. It just all is bad from the Pepco and the power rates we pay to how politics and pay-for-play politics will or won't be tolerating the city. It's just been a huge mess.
Just one matter before we get to the D.C. schools, Chancellor. By the way, are you expecting any money back from the fresh back return of money to donors?
If they would like to contribute to the D.C. Public Education Fund, we would put that money to good
there
use.
There you go.
In other words, she was not a donor to the...
She doesn't donate to politicians.
To
the fresh back fund. But Washington, D.C., Tom, is now the newest member of something called the Unrepresented Nations of and Peoples Organization. It is an organization consisting of people who are, in a way, stateless because they are indigenous peoples, minorities, and others who are living in occupied territories. Not a group of people that you would generally associate with the District of Columbia, but because of the lack of voting rights and statehood in the District of Columbia, one of our statehood senators, Paul Strauss, decided that this would be a good organization to be a part of. A really unusual strategy here.
Well, as one person said to me, I'm tired of gimmicks. This is kind of gimmicky to go to this organization. You know, the UN and the Organization of American States have weighed in on the fact that the people of this city are not treated like other Americans, that we're the most un-American city in America. Going to this organization where there is real, I mean, even the supporters of doing this acknowledge that in the world there are countries and places where there is horrific treatment of people who are stateless or who are treated as stateless and who do not have the rights that they ought to have. But that in no way compares to the District of Columbia. That's probably one of the problems. People don't see the harm to this city so easily. So it's a nice little short story, maybe in the newspaper or something like that. But it's not the hard work of pointing up to 650,000 people are treated as second-class citizens.
In case you're just joining us, our guest is Kaya Henderson. She is the D.C. Schools Chancellor. We're taking your calls at 800-433-8850. You have been at the helm for 5 years now, a relatively long tenure for the head of a school district the size of D.C. So let's start out nice. There's a lot to celebrate. There's a lot to celebrate. A school system once near the bottom nationally in student achievement has been improving fairly rapidly. But I'd like to know what you are most proud of having accomplished for D.C. schools.
Well, I think what I'm most proud of is really changing people's perception about what D.C. public schools could be. For a long time, people fled the system. People counted us out. People never thought that DCPS could be successful again. And we once had been one of the best places in the country for African Americans to get an education. And in fact, I meet parents every day who tell me that their kids have gone through DCPS and are now successful, but I don't think people believe that that could be the case anymore. And now enrollment is up for the fourth consecutive year in a row after 40 years of enrollment decline, which means I think families and citizens have a renewed perspective on DCPS. And I think, you know, a city, the vibrancy of a city hinges upon its school district. And I think we are contributing in ways that we haven't before to the vibrancy of a nation's capital.
Well, you know, your predecessor, Michelle Reed, took the steering wheel of the school system and yanked it and turned and forced a new direction. You were her deputy chancellor. And you've continued that progress to mostly great praise from lots of people. But you've recognized that, you know, changing direction and getting on the road to improvement is different from speeding down the road. And you've done a lot of good things. But I'm just going to ask right up about a part of all the criticism, what the good, the bad, whatever you've done. You have said to me on camera and other times that you have thought that 2017 would be your exit year as chancellor. Is that still...
Well, what I said, and I actually said it on this show, I think, for the first time, was that 2017 will be 10 years in leadership at D.C. public schools. That is a long time. In real life, that's like 70 years, right? And so...
Maybe more.
And so at that point, I think I owe it to myself personally to ask, am I the right person to continue leading this organization? After 10 years, you know, I might be, or there might be somebody else who could take it from, you know, good to great.
So we don't want to get into a Metro situation of having a new GM for Metro. So I was talking to someone who was asking me, if you think you might go in 2017, that means in 2016, it's just next months away, at some point, What do you think, how will you prepare for a successor? Mm-hmm. Now, it depends, you know, the mayor makes that appointment, but you've been in the trenches. So as you potentially decide you're going to leave in 2017, what do we see happening in terms of bringing someone in, or does that somebody come totally new in 2017? When do you make that decision?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that you can, there are possibilities for you in a Democratic administration, maybe in a Republican one. There are possibilities for you to go into business and actually earn money.
Money. I mean, mm-hmm.
Things like that. But for a transition for the parents who've bought into your reform, how do they buy in knowing that you will be leaving and the Michelle Rhee, Kaya Henderson era may be over?
Well, I think that we have to get past this single person narrative, right? The work that Michelle did in DCPS was not just Michelle. I was there. Lots of our team was there. Lots of our principals and our educators were there. And I actually think that me succeeding Michelle helps to define a new paradigm. There's talent within our district. We have great people in DCPS who could step into my shoes, who are preparing for superintendencies, and people all across the country are looking to tap my team, and they could go to other places for sure. But I think that there is something to continuity of strategy. And so if there are people within DCPS who could step into the role, I would advise the mayor that that is a much more viable strategy than having somebody come into the district who doesn't know the district, who doesn't know the path that we've been on, and who might be committed to a very different way. I think we've had a lot of experience with that in this city. I'm right. Something like my, 15th or 17th superintendent since I moved here in 97. And we've done a lot of that and hadn't seen the kinds of results. So I would suggest that we look at succession from within.
So the clock is ticking because we'll be into the 2016-2017 school year in September, right?
Yes.
So we're just talking about your maybe, would you make a decision by the time that school year starts?
Not thinking about that. I still got a lot of work to do day to day. I think the mayor and I will have to sit down and figure out when she's comfortable making that decision. And you all have asked me is, how long do I think I would like to stay, right? We have to negotiate my contract right about now for next year, so.
Okay. All right. So much for nice. High teacher and principal turnover in D.C. schools has been a concern for a while. Given how important experience is in the classroom, what does it mean that some 500 teachers left or were fired going into this school year?
500 teachers left or were fired going into this school year. We have 4,100 teachers. 500 teachers leave every year. Mm-hmm. So that's our normal attrition. We hired 750 teachers, which means we didn't just replace the people who left or were fired. We, in fact, added to our teaching force. We've been adding to our teaching force for the last couple years so that we've been able to offer our young people and our families a richer set of academic programs. I think that churn is a concern, but I don't think that it is the concern that some people make it. For a couple reasons. So one, the principalship is not the job that it used to be. My best principals will tell you that it's not a job that you get in and stay in for 20 years anymore. In fact, we're demanding very different things out of the leadership role. And we're trying to actually think about how we make it more sustainable. So we have directors of school operations who assist principals in all of the operational functions of a school building so that their job can really be focused on instruction.
What is it that we don't understand about how the job of principal is changing that makes it no longer a requirement for a principal to stay for a long period of time in order for a school to be stable?
I think previously, the main job of a principal was to manage a school. They didn't have to be an instructional leader necessarily. Some were not. They didn't have to be a community engager in the way that we now believe. I mean, previously, educators just thought, well, have the families drop their kids off at the door. We're the experts, and we'll do our jobs, and in 12th grade, we'll turn them out. And what we know is we are much more successful when we engage with our families, but we've had to teach our educators and our leaders how to do that differently. They have have to manage the business operations of a school. They have to be great talent managers. They have to, I mean, there are just so many dimensions of the job that I think previously they were not responsible for. And what we know is when they actually are responsible for all of those things, they run a better organization. But I have great principals who after 5 or 7 years say, I'd love to take a break. I'd love to come to central office, or I want to take a year off or whatever.
A related issue, fewer and fewer African-American teachers are in D.C. classrooms. What are some of the issues you think that are leading to that, and what can be done to address it?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of issues around that as well. One, many of you know, and I know this from my days of being a recruiter and in admissions, we have a lot of competition for the small number of African Americans who graduate from college. And many careers are much more lucrative than teaching. This is one of the reasons why we moved to significantly improve the salaries in DCPS. And we're now capturing many more people who would have never considered teaching because of the economics. I think that, you know, we also have a lot of competition from our surrounding jurisdictions. And we see teachers moving amongst the metropolitan area. You know, I think having teachers who reflect the diversity of the students that we serve is important, but having good teachers of all shapes, sizes, colors, races, whatever, is important. And we're trying to be the place where the best teachers want to come and stay.
You described the complex role of principals. But most of them have one-year contracts. I think this is the first year you now have some with three-year contracts.
Is that
right? Doesn't the description you just gave for principals argue for longer-term contracts for principals so they can sink into the community and know the whole place where they are rather than having to be re-upped every year?
I'm re-upped every year. I'm on a one-year contract.
You're on one-year contracts?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that's okay with me because I feel like I know what I have to do, and I put myself in position every year to be able to be renewed. I think on the principal front, the reason why we offered three-year contracts, the way I think about it is this. You know, in our ideal world, when we hire a new principal for a school, we generally think they'll be there for 3 years. It'll be 3 years before they really get off the ground and running. We have some principals who kill it in year one, some who don't kill it till year three, but by year three, you should be really cranking. If not, then we think about whether or not that's the right fit for you or what have you. But in some cases, there are people who, you know, hiring is an inexact science. And so if we decide very early on that that's not the right fit, we need to reserve the right to be able to find something different for that person. But when people have proven that they are great school leaders, we want to give them the security of a longer term contract, and that's why we went to these 3 year contracts this year.
On to the phones. Here is Bruce in Washington. Bruce, you are on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I was involved in a school based mourning project through the Wendt Center as a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst with a team to help kids deal with inner-city kids deal with loss and trauma. One way of emphasizing this is that I had a chance at a very early primary to talk to Obama, who was talking about No Child Left Behind. And my view was this. The superintendent is very important. The administration is very important. The buildings are very important. The curriculum is very important. The teachers are extremely important. Usually positive, but sometimes you see teachers beating the kids.
Where are you going with this?
Okay, I'm going to the very last sentence as I started. What's really needed if you want kids to stay in school and not be pregnant or in the criminal justice system is mental health services, early and frequent, in order to deal with the traumas and sexual overstimulation and sexual traumas that they have. And without dealing with those issues, kids are not going to be able to learn.
Kaya Henderson.
We fundamentally know that many of our young people face mental health issues. And I'm really pleased that under the mayor's direction, we partner with the Department of Behavioral Health. In addition to the psychologists and social workers that we provide in our schools, the Department of Behavioral Health has helped us to focus on our 40 lowest performing schools and ensuring that we have additional clinicians there to help with some of the mental health issues that our young people and our families face. We also have a great partnership with a nonprofit organization called Turnaround for Children, which does trauma-informed instructional practices with teachers in a number of our schools. And so we're beginning to address some of the mental health issues. The Chairman Grasso, the chair of the Education Committee, has been a great partner on this. He understands that our focus, you know, really needs to be on teaching and learning, and he's trying to help us figure out how we put the pieces in place that wrap around the social services that our young people need, because whether it's nutrition issues or mental health issues or, you know, housing instability, those all meet at the schoolhouse.
Bruce, thank you very much for your call.
I want to ask about how we're doing on middle schools, because during the mayoral campaign, middle schools and the future of middle schools were important, because the thought is that the elementary schools do pretty well of preparing the children in our city for the next level, but that middle schools were lacking. The mayor herself said she wants an Alice deal for all students, which is a reference to the school in Ward 3 that's so popular. But is there progress on the middle school level? Because the young people who are having children and they're going into the elementary schools, they want to look ahead. One told me just yesterday, I need to look ahead beyond the child in the first or second grade. Mm-hmm. Where will my child go for middle school?
Yeah. So we've made some pretty heavy investments in ensuring, I think when the mayor says Alice deal for all, Alice Deal is a huge school, over 1,000 kids, and not every middle schooler
could have 2,000 if you had the room.
Not every middle schooler needs that kind of experience. But I think the plethora of academic and extracurricular offerings that Deal has, in part because of its size, are things that we want to offer to all of our young people. And so we've made those investments to ensure that our young people have a lot of different offerings, from art and music and PE and foreign language to high school algebra, in some cases geometry at the middle grades level, foreign languages. We're raising money, in fact, right now to ensure that all of our eighth graders are able to go on international trips.
That'd be cool.
And private one money. Philanthropic money. But one of the things that I think our middle schools have to overcome is the bad rap that middle schools are just bad. If you walk
discipline
into
problems.
And people haven't visited our middle schools. Yesterday, I posted on my Twitter account an algebra project that the eighth graders at Stuart Hobson were doing using bungee jumping to figure out algebraic equations. There are amazing things happening in our middle grades. Our middle grades growth has been the largest over the last 8 years when we look at test scores, when we look at our attendance rates, when we look at student satisfaction. We're seeing a lot of positives in middle school, and I would challenge people to go visit their neighborhood middle schools. There are awesome gems like Jefferson Middle School, which is an amazing place, and there are families who literally just won't consider it because what they've heard about Jefferson or what happened.
It's hard to overcome
Amber
bad
in
reputation.
Washington has a question having to do with middle schools. Amber, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, thank you, and thank you for all that you do, Chancellor Henderson.
Thanks.
I'm a parent of two girls at Maury, a thriving Capitol Hill, D.C. public elementary school. Mm-hmm. And each year, our fourth-grade families face the heart-wrenching decision of leaving for middle school charters, mm-hmm. which start in fifth grade, or staying in the DCPS system in the middle schools, which start in sixth. Mm-hmm. Why don't our middle schools in both the charter and the DCPS system align in terms of their starting grade?
Well, it's interesting. Previously, they did. And then the charters decided that they could get a jump on families by starting earlier. And because we don't have any kind of common planning common opportunities for alignment, they made those decisions. And those decisions, in fact, are attracting families, I think, away from DCPS at earlier grades. one of the things that I'm proud of is we're seeing actually a lot of families who want to continue. They want their kids to be in the same fifth grade class and graduate with their friends and, in fact, move on to schools. We're seeing a lot of that kind of thing happening, for example, at Hardy, where that never happened before, even at Elliott Hine and at Jefferson. And so I think, you know, we don't, one of the things that the Deputy Mayor for Education is looking at is a cross-sector task force, which will help to bring some of these issues to the forefront. But it was a competitive decision to get market share to start middle schools and charters earlier.
We got an email from Anna, who identifies herself as a former DCPS teacher and a three-time recipient of DC Excellence in Teaching Award. Anna writes, Kaya Henderson has indicated that, quoting here, redefining what quality means in the educator workforce is a next priority and that the process is bound to, quoting again, lead to churn. What criteria, asks Anna, will define quality? Will the algorithm be transparent?
So I'm not exactly sure to what she is referring, but I think we've been in a constant quest to ensure that we have the best educators, and we don't think that you just recruit the best educators. We have to grow our educators. I'm really proud of our teacher evaluation system because one of the big headlines from a study that Johns Hopkins and Stanford did show that we're improving our educator force in part by growing through professional development our teachers. We know that with the more rigorous Common Core standards-based work that we're doing, a lot of our teachers don't have the content knowledge to be able to be expert in this new work. And so we are shifting our focus to ensure that we can provide that for them and grow them so that they can be exceptional.
Educate the teachers.
There's been a lot of pushback against testing in schools as a way to evaluate both students and teachers this week. The American Educational Research Association became the latest organization to flag issues with using student test scores to evaluate teacher performance. How much do those test scores factor into teacher evaluations here in the district?
So in Washington, D.C., we do use student test scores or growth in student test scores as part of our teacher evaluation. About 13% of our teachers teach in tested grades or subject areas. And so for those 13%, their test scores factor into their evaluations at about 35%.
Well, I was trying to avoid doing a rant about all the changes in schools and education bureaucracy.
Well, I should tell you, Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Cut that rant in half. Our guest is Kaya Henderson. She is the D.C. Schools Chancellor. Back to rant.
Okay, well, part of the Common Core is something called the PARC. Is that what it's called, the short word?
The test that measures, yes.
And I think this is just some of the bureaucratic constipation that hurts the school system. I mean, I would hate to be a parent now and be told that your students participate in something called, and I'm quoting, Partnership for Assessment of Readiness for College and Careers. All that means is, are people ready for a job? Or
so it is a marketing problem, I mean, for sure. But
just, I mean, I just find all of this, you know, the Common Core, back to basics. I mean, they all sound like 7-year plans, you know.
So just, here's what I'm going to tell you, and I think
I've asked you this on this program before.
Have you?
I just think you guys are not you. But the education world is just so far from reading, writing, and arithmetic that it just drives me crazy.
Well, sounds like lawyers, huh?
You're right. It is far from reading, writing, and arithmetic for a couple reasons. One,
the language, not the instructions.
One, reading, writing, and arithmetic alone just don't cut it anymore. If our young people are going to be prepared for jobs and to be successful in college, we have to do something different. I think what people are not saying is we are going through a significant watershed moment in education. And we're trying to act like, oh, we just have some new standards, or we just have a new curriculum, or we just have a new test. We're actually asking the educational system to do something that it has never done before, and that is educate all students. This system was not designed to educate all students.
And we have a rapidly changing world of the
That's
internet,
right.
And jobs are being lost to the internet and other things. So you've got to prepare students for the new world.
That's right. You have to prepare students to think And in fact, K-12 used to prepare students with a set of facts that they needed to know to be good citizens and a couple of skills that you needed to know to manage a budget or what have you. And in college, you learned how to think. You learned how to think critically. You learned how to write. You learned how to extrapolate across different subject areas. Now, in fact, K-12 has to do that. And we haven't trained our teachers to be able to do that. We haven't set up our curriculum to be able to do that. So there's a lot going on right now. And the noise that you hear is, I think, some of the disconnects around not being prepared. The whole opt-out movement is fascinating to me, right? Because people think they're opting out of the PARC test. The PARC test is so bad, right? Mm-hmm. The test is not bad. The test is actually, if you look at the test, you'd think, wow, if my kid knew that, I'd be inspired. But what happened was states and districts failed to prepare for the PARC. They didn't give their teachers the curriculum that they needed or the professional development. And so you can imagine a teacher teaching all year long and then getting this exam that has nothing to do with what they've been teaching and the level of frustration that that creates for the teacher and the kid. And then the parent is like, forget it. If that test is causing this kind of anxiety, I want out.
I must say, I looked at a five-minute, I went online and looked at a five-minute explainer about what the PARC test is. I won't read that whole list again, but it was dismaying to me because it was filled with five different categories, and you get this score and you get that score, and I'm thinking, children are not robotic cars that we're putting together. You're trying to do all these things. It just seems to me that the education world is going to suffer on the bureaucracy of trying to make this major change.
So that might be the case. I think the implementation of the Common Core standards in the PARC has been troublesome. But for us, it's actually been freeing and creative. And our teachers, in part because we have prepared appropriately and introduced new curriculum, our teachers report to me that they're refinding the joy of teaching. We're no longer looking at textbooks which chew up and spit out American history. They're teaching from primary source documents like the Declaration of Independence, right? And the letter from a Birmingham jail. They're able to do what they came to teaching to do.
Can I ask one more question about security? Sure. And I know is this the first full year that some students can ride free to schools, both in high school and middle school, is that right?
So this is the first year they can ride free on the trains. They could ride free on the bus last year.
One of the parents at Wilson, which is another popular school, not far from here, says that you guys have been much tougher on people coming to school on time and being in class at the start of the year, and that's a good thing. But I'm told that at Wilson, that you only have one metal detector. All the high school's kids have to go through metal detectors, but there's only like one or two at Wilson. And so students who even get there for 8:45 can't get into the school. And even if they're in line to get into school, they're treated as tardy, and they have to sit out until 9:30 to the next class. And they say they're standing in line to get into school, but you have so few metal detectors, they can't get into the school for these programs.
Yep, so this is the first that I'm hearing about that. I'm happy to look into it. I don't know that issue off the top of my head.
I asked, it was a parent talking about his child who has to get there early in order to get in line.
If that's the case, I'll talk to my operations team and we can get some more metal detectors.
It's sad that we have to have the metal detectors. If we have them, we ought to have enough.
Yep. Okay.
Here is Jennifer in Washington, D.C. Jennifer, your turn.
Hi. I had a question about what does it take for a parent body and even a teacher body to get rid of a principal that they're not satisfied with. My children attended Lafayette Elementary School last year, and both the homeschool association did not like the newly hired principal. The teachers didn't like the newly hired principal. She was actually written up in the Washington Teacher Union blog as a bully. There were numerous complaints. I know of dozens of complaints, actually, that parents made down to DCPS. And nothing happened. The principal was rehired.
What does it take to get a principal fired if the parents don't happen to approve of the principal?
Well,
although it's not a democracy.
I think that is a very important point. So I can't speak about that particular situation for personnel reasons, but I can say broadly that we take parent and teacher input very seriously. Sometimes there are issues at schools that parents and teachers are not aware of. Sometimes we need to make changes at schools. And of course, if changes need to be made, then sometimes, you know, teachers aren't supportive of those changes or parents might not be supportive of those changes. It's a difficult kind of thing to balance what is popular and what we believe we need to do for the school moving forward. I remember making some really tough decisions around popular principles and then having school communities come back and say, actually, you know what? We get it. We see something different happening now. And so thanks. It's one of the tougher parts of our job, and that is that all of the information that we use to make those decisions are not available to everybody.
The contract you have with the teachers union here
is incidentally, it's the first time we've mentioned the Washington Teachers Union, and it used to be that's all we would talk about. It was the conflict between the school and the teachers union.
Let the record show that I was the first to mention it.
Go ahead.
The contract you have with the teachers union gives you pretty wide latitude either to fire teachers or to reward them with significant raises based on performance evaluations. How important is it to have that latitude?
It's incredibly important. I think, you know, the single most important in-school factor to moving student achievement is the quality of the teacher. And, you know, while I've only been in leadership at DCPS for 8 years, I've worked in or with this system for 18 years. And I saw principals struggle trying to remove teachers who were either ineffective or just unconcerned anymore. I saw great teachers who were never recognized or rewarded for their hard work. I saw teachers leaving the system who said, if somebody just asked me to stay, that would be great and I'd stick around, but it doesn't seem to matter. And I think what the contract allows us to do is create a system and an environment where we're serious about the caliber of our teachers, and we're able to deal with that when we're not getting the appropriate caliber, and we're able to support and recognize that when we are.
The head of the American Federation of Teachers has said she is disappointed there's not more collaboration in addressing issues, that there's still an us versus them attitude. How
Me
do you
too.
Overcome that?
This has been a very interesting time for us, because despite all of the fussing and fighting that has been characteristic of DCPS and the Washington Teachers Union, we still got a lot of things accomplished together. That 2010 contract was groundbreaking. Nobody in the country has a contract like that. And I think the WTU would tell you that teachers got a lot out of that, and so did the district. I think, you know, we are currently in the situation where we don't have a contract. And Liz Davis and I met yesterday in efforts to restart negotiations. And I'm hopeful that this go round we'd be able to work on some things and get them accomplished together.
You're not going to negotiate in public, obviously, but is there, how do teacher salaries, which is kind of a baseline thing, fit compared to other schools? Is that something that needs to go up? Or are we going to talk about like the fire and police department to get 2 or 3% pay increases? Or do we need more?
It's interesting.
I know you'd give a lot more if you just could write the check.
But so previously we looked at across the board pay raises every year because our teachers were woefully underpaid. And so we were trying to get them up to a standard. At this point, our teachers are fairly handsomely paid. And so compensation is not the number one issue on the table. If you look out, the average teacher is seeing increases between our built-in cost of living increases and what they're earning in bonuses of 2 to 3% at least a year. Across the board salary increase may not be the answer. Let me give you an example. An across the board increase of 1% costs $20 million, right? Yeah. So we are at a point where, you know, we'll see what mark we get from the mayor. Education is a huge priority, but so is
so maybe the length of the work day, study periods, or the time in the classrooms, things like that are subject to negotiation.
The management gets the right to set the tour of duty for the length of the work day and whatnot. We have to negotiate with the WTU to ensure that we're appropriately paid. paying and compensating for that time, but that's one of my huge priorities.
Loose Lips recently reported that your Rolodex and calendar include some of the biggest donors and foundations in the world of school reform, and that a lot of these heavyweights in school reform are generally pro-charter. Some are outright anti-teachers union. What does that mean for D.C.'s public school system, which some feel is under threat from charters and reformers who oppose teacher tenure, for example?
Well, I wish Loose Lips had asked me what these various things mean. Lots of times I'm invited to talk to people. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're giving me money. And you can look very clearly. The D.C. Public Education Fund has a full list of our donors, and you can see who gives to us and who does not give to us. I think, you know, there are a lot of people who support both charters and D.C. public schools, and we're happy to, you know, make good use of their money and as we improve the school district. I think there's a big conversation that is happening in town. Citizens want to know, how do these two systems fit together? How do these, you know, we're now at a point where charters educate 40% of the K through 12 population, and they continue to grow. And families are saying, I don't want to be in a lottery. I want my neighborhood school. I want, what does this all mean? And so I think we as a city have to begin to answer that question. And a deputy mayor for education has taken that on.
Well, one of the things, the reason charters started and people thought they would be good is because if you created competition, it would force the city or any school system, it will force the school system to respond by making the public schools better. And that is, in fact, what has happened. The competition, if we did not have the charters as a go-to place for parents, the school system may never have improved. So but you're saying we've gotten beyond that initial point now, and then it's how we're going to coexist going forward.
Well, I think for people, you know, we have a finite amount of resources in the city. We want to make sure that we are allocating them to cover as many young people as possible. And there are some redundancies in the two systems. There are places where we're both doing the same thing, and then there are other neighborhoods that are not getting serviced. And so I think that we have to figure out what the complementary relationship is. The competition piece, if competition was to wake up the public school system, it took a long while because we've had charters for almost 20 years. And, you know, if you look at the improvements in DCPS, they've really been in the last decade. But now we're awake and we're competing and we're outperforming on a lot of indicators.
And at some point, it's a sensitive issue, but at some point you'll have to talk about how the two can have the same kind of management so that you can take away some of those redundancies.
Well, I think one of the things that we have to sort of figure out is you can't say things are good for some schools and not good for others. So if some schools have flexibility and autonomy, then that's a good thing. Shouldn't all schools have that? And I think those are some of the things that we've got to reconcile.
On to Karen in Bethesda. Karen, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, thank you, Kojo. So, yes, I am not in the D.C. public school system. My children are not. We're in Montgomery County. But I still have questions. You mentioned before, your guest mentioned before, how the Common Core focuses more on how to think instead of, you know, memorizing facts. Now, I have a fifth grader who is completely confused because there's so many, it's like, here are four different ways to think about this instead of a clear, concise, all right, do this, this, and this, and you will get the right answer every time. So I wonder, what do you do about these kids who are lost on this, who aren't even learning the basic facts and are not learning how to think and are just overwhelmed? And because it's the mandated curriculum, the teachers aren't going to teach them a different way.
So again, I think, you know, this is a challenge area for a lot of our teachers and a lot of us as parents because we weren't taught this way. And so teaching our young people to think this way is very difficult for us all. And I think that we're on a journey and we've got to get better much more quickly at ensuring that our fifth graders are not confused when they think about four ways to solve a problem. But we live in a world where there is no longer one right way to solve a problem. And so we've got to make sure that we're teaching our young people both the facts and the ways to think about them. Again, I think we're selling our families short by not really explaining how difficult this work is and why we're in this sort of gray area right now, but we need a lot more teacher development to be good at this.
I'd like to go to Sue in Annapolis on the issue of Common Core. Sue, your turn.
Hi, Kojo. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm really enjoying this conversation. I am not an advocate of Common Core. I have a middle-aged child, a middle school child that's in a private school. I pay $12,000 a year just to keep them away from Common Core. My question is, how do you guys keep our child's grades and data safe? Where is it housed? How is it? Who has access to our child's grades? How is it protected? How are we protecting our children from big data? Thank you.
So I can only speak for DC Public Schools. We have a student information system called Aspen, where we house all of our grades, all of our young people's information, attendance data, et cetera. And the only people who have access to that are DC Public Schools employees. We don't export that data to other companies or anything. We do work with a couple of digital gradebook providers like Blackboard or Ngrade, which pull data from our student information system that make it available to parents and students. But again, all of it is secure sign-on, and again, we don't, outside of the digital interface for parents, we don't work with any other companies regarding our student data.
I have a question about supplies. It used to be, I think Vincent Orange, a council member, had to get the council to pass a law that the books would be in the classrooms on time at the start of the year and all that. We're way behind, I mean, way beyond that now. But I also noticed this year, I was part of a parent group at Garrison Elementary where they were asking people to donate supplies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went and bought a case of pencils or whatever and took them by Garrison one Saturday morning. And there were things there. And I thought, well, these look like pretty basic things. On the one hand, it gets parents and people who support the schools a chance to participate and bring. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, is it a signal that maybe there are not enough supplies available? I know our supply cabinet at our place gets raided all the time and this stuff disappears. But is that a sign that we're still not giving the schools enough materials?
So thank you for asking that question. This is something
that... Thank me for giving the pencils?
No, this is... No.
He swiped the pencils from NBC, but that's another story.
I have the receipt.
Here's the thing. We have pushed more and more money down to schools so that they're able to buy supplies. We don't think that schools should be asking parents for paper or pencils or what have you. And so schools have actually quite a lot in their non-personnel budget to take care of supplies. In addition to that, we give every teacher a $250 supply card that they're able to buy supplies with. And this year, we added to the budget a $20 per student allocation for art supplies, science supplies, music supplies, etc. There is so much money in schools for supplies that we often see at the end of the fiscal year schools leaving money on the table. What I think is happening is parents do want a way to contribute, and buying supplies is easy and quick. And, you know, my kid's school is looking for recess equipment. And I know for sure that there is probably room in the budget to buy recess equipment. But if parents want to buy it, then the principal's smart, right? If the parents buy the recess equipment, then she can spend that money on more professional development for teachers or something like that. It is strategic on the part of principals as a way to bring families in, but it does communicate that we're not appropriately funding schools, and I think that that's not always the case.
So it should be fundraising or for bonus things, not basic things.
Absolutely.
Okay. We got an email from Meredith who says, our last elementary school principal recited this regularly as the teachers had professional development days at least one out of every 20 or fewer days. Substitutes became regulars in the classroom and have no training or instructions. We left DCPS this year for a DC public charter, and their new teachers do professional development in summer evenings and at other times so they can actually be in class during class instruction time. How can you address this?
Yeah, it's one of the things that we are challenged by. We cannot mandate that teachers do professional development in the evenings or on the weekends or the summertime without negotiating that through the contract and paying for it. And so we have built in time during the day to be able to do it. One of the benefits, in fact, that we're seeing in our extended day programs is we're able to make the schedule in such a way so that teachers actually get a significant amount of planning and professional development time as a block during the day when we have a longer school day. So that's another reason why we're pursuing that. We know, I was with my teacher cabinet the other day and they said, well, we need more training on special ed, or we need more training on the curriculum, or we need more training on mental health issues and whatnot. There's not enough time in the day to be able to do all of the things that we need to.
What's the teacher cabinet?
The teacher cabinet is a group that I meet with monthly. It represents highly effective teachers from all across the city, every ward, every grade level, a variety of subject areas, and they advise me on a lot of key issues.
Here's Deborah in Washington. We have about 2 minutes left, Deborah, but go ahead, please.
Hi. My sons both started at a D.C. charter school and have since moved to D.C. public schools, and we're very happy.
Woohoo! Welcome back.
Yes. My concern is about the survey that went out last week about extending the school day by 2 hours and potentially the school year by 20 days. One of the reasons why we finally left the charter was because they did have that extended day. Mm-hmm. And by 4:15, my son, my fifth grader, he was shot. He was coming home crying with a headache. He was learning nothing. His accelerated.
All right, we're short on time, so allow me to have this.
Let me say this. So, one, we know that the extended day works for some schools and some kids and not others. It's not something that I think every school in DCPS needs. And part of the reason why we're doing a survey is to figure out what families want. If we have schools where families say that's not important to us or that's not what we want to do, then we want to be respectful of that.
We're out of time. Can you hold up that jar of green goo that you've been drinking during the program?
Exactly.
What is that?
It's been a major distraction for me.
Distracted too.
It's cold pressed juice. It's kale, cucumber, apple, lemon, ginger, and pineapple.
What does this do for you?
It's an infusion. It's like drinking your vegetables. You should have five servings of vegetables a day. And it is healthy and it gives me energy and it's better than drinking Red Bull.
And do you make that or do you
You
buy it already squashed together?
I used to make it, but it adds an hour on the morning to, like, you got to go to the grocery store, buy all of the junk, juice it, and then clean your machine. So now I just buy it.
Kaya Henderson is D.C. Schools Chancellor. Try scotch sometimes. She joined us in studio. Kaya Henderson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with The Current Newspapers. Tom, always a pleasure.
More coming on Fresh Pack.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nam.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Namdi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.